Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's opening of the George W. Bush Presidential Library in Dallas, attended by five living U.S. presidents. We will discuss the legacy of the 43rd president and recent attempts at revisionist history by some Republicans suggesting that he wasn't all that bad. Paul Glastras, the editor-in-chief of The Washington Monthly, joins us to discuss his new e-book, Elephant in the Room, Washington in the Bush Years. Then we'll speak with Michael Cohen, who is a columnist for the UK Guardian and The Observer, where he has an article, Why Does America Lose Its Head Over Terror But Ignore Its Daily Gun Deaths? We will examine the paradox of our inordinate fear of random violence from terrorists compared to our acceptance of the daily death toll from guns and the preventable workplace deaths of 14 Americans every day, as well as try to understand why 3,531 Americans, more than were killed on 9/11, have died from guns since Newtown. Yet a majority of Americans are not as motivated to do something about it as the 1% who belong to the NRA, who are highly motivated to ensure that America's criminals and terrorists are the best armed in the world. Then finally, we will discuss the corporate takeover of food as powerful corporations like Monsanto are able to show how they can flex their political muscle in Congress and shut down the judicial branch of government. Frederick Kaufman, a contributing editor at Harper's, joins us to discuss his new book, Bet the Farm, How Food Stopped Being Food. And while our food gets less healthy and more expensive, explain the hidden connection between global food and global finance. Joining us now is Paul Glastras, who is the editor-in-chief of The Washington Monthly and a senior fellow at the Western Policy Center in Washington, D.C. From September 1998 to January 2001, he was a special assistant and former speechwriter to President Bill Clinton. He wrote over 200 speeches for the president on subjects ranging from education to health care to the budget. Before joining the White House, Paul Glastras spent 10 years as a correspondent and editor at U.S. News and World Report. His new e-book is Elephant in the Room, Washington in the Bush Years. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Glastras.
Glad to be here.
And there is, of course, an effort underway by some Republicans in terms of revisionist history that's suggesting that George W. Bush wasn't all that bad. Your new e-book, of course, tracks his presidency with some of the great political writers like Nicholas Confessori and Josh Marshall. But let me just sort of sketch out the big issues that, I mean, we know about the Iraq War and the Afghan War, both of which the first one, the Iraq War, we lost and Iran won, and it's cost God knows how many trillions. And then the other one, I don't think there's any way in the world we're going to win it, the Afghan War. The other signatures, of course, are his education. He wanted to be the education president, and No Child Left Behind looks like it's turned into a cheating scandal, in effect, because they've created this extraordinary new metric in education where tests are more important than education, in effect. So people are cheating in order to get the incentives and disincentives that the system has. The ownership society that he came up with ended up being the engine that drove the subprime loan bubble that created the great recession. So I guess I should stop here and ask you, what do we have to celebrate today in terms of George W. Bush's achievements?
Well, what's happening today, obviously, as you mentioned, is the opening of the president's library. You had all the living ex-presidents and President Obama there. Everybody gave, you know, speeches that were, especially President Obama's, quite gracious and complimentary of the president, President Bush. The word Iraq did not leave anybody's lips. They avoided sort of wading into the into anything that might be overtly critical of the president, and this was his day to be celebrated. There was a lot of talk in the run-up to this day of his President Bush's approval ratings having nudged up some, certainly higher than they were when he left office. And there's this sort of drumbeat in the media, because the media loves contrarian stories, that, you know, Bush is back. Bush's reputation is healing. People like Bush. They miss him. They are reminded of what they liked about him, et cetera, et cetera. I think it is a hard path for President Bush to be rehabilitated. And that's true not just with people who didn't vote for him, such as Democrats. It's true with Republicans. And while there are some Republicans, essentially people who worked for George W. Bush or were closely associated with his administration, to rehabilitate him, let's remember that it was Republicans who, in the last 4 or 5 or 6 years, but especially since he left office, almost wholly repudiated his administration. He was seen as, a lot of people who cheered him in, when his poll ratings were up, decided that in the end he was too liberal or moderate or not conservative enough. So a lot of the upswing, such as it is in his poll ratings, is among some Republicans who have softened a little bit and are maybe more moderate themselves. He still has a much lower post-presidency approval rating than Jimmy Carter. And so the argument that people are looking fondly on Bush, I think, is a little premature. I think that, as most of the people who've written about this day have mentioned, he does have some positive accomplishments that will go down in the record books. He was president for 8 years. He did give a couple of very, very important unifying speeches after 9/11 that people will remember and that were appreciated at the time. He had his AIDS in Africa work, which almost across the board he gets praise for. Something I haven't heard that I think is worth mentioning is that he, following up on Bill Clinton's opening to India in his last year of his administration, President Bush sealed a partnership with India that had been a kind of a cold peace during the Cold War, and helped bring together the world's two biggest democracies. That's not a small thing. So there are things that his fans can point to, but overwhelmingly, I think history will judge him very, very harshly. It was not a competent administration. It was not a successful administration. I think, short of a tremendous turnaround in Iraq, it is hard to see him ever living down, bringing America into a war that we subsequently knew we didn't have to fight, and ill-managing Afghanistan, ill-managing the disaster in New Orleans, ill-managing the economy, failing to put in the regulations that might have stopped the recession of 2008. It is a pretty sorry record, and the public has rendered a judgment on it. And the book that you mentioned, our e-book, Elephant in the Room, essentially argues that though the 2012 election was said to be
a referendum.
A referendum, thank you, Ian, on Barack Obama, it was really a referendum on George W. Bush. Because when you looked at the numbers, poll after poll showed that the public blamed George W. Bush overwhelmingly more than Barack Obama for the poor economy. And it was the failure of the Romney administration, the Romney campaign, to understand that when they talked down the economy, the public kind of gave Barack Obama, as late as November of 2012, a kind of a break, because they thought he inherited a mess. So President Bush's legacy extends all the way, I would argue, to the re-election of Barack Obama.
Well, again, I speak with Paul Glasrost, the editor-in-chief of The Washington Monthly, and he's the editor of a new e-book, Elephant in the Room, Washington in the Bush Years. Now, there was a recent documentary on Showtime featuring Dick Cheney, where he was given ample opportunity to do his own revisionist history, and he's blissfully unaware of anything that went wrong in the first 4 years. Actually the whole 8 years, but the first 4 years, you come away from this film with the distinct impression that the first 4 years of the Bush administration, Dick Cheney was really the president. I mean, when the recount was happening down in Florida and Bush was just twiddling his thumbs, Cheney was up in Washington putting together a government. He chose all the people. He put them in all the key positions. It was only late in the first term that Bush found out that Cheney was doing end runs around him, right, left, and center. And by the halfway through the second term, and certainly towards the end of the second term, Bush and Cheney weren't even speaking, and I don't believe they've spoken since. So, can you make a case that Bush is not a two-term president? He's a one-term president.
Well, maybe that's a little too much, but I think the point is it's a fair point that Dick Cheney was in the tradition of strong vice presidents that arguably began with Walter Mondale and Al Gore was a very powerful vice president. Dick Cheney was probably our most powerful vice president for that first term. In our ebook, we have a story by Josh Marshall, called Vice Grip, that was written, I think, in 2002 or 2003, at a time when everyone was saying, well, Dick Cheney, he's a steady hand on the tiller, experienced, sober, he'll be a good influence on George W. Bush. Well, we could see then, and it is now obvious to all now, that some of the worst ideas of the Bush years were Cheney's. As you point out, he had his people throughout the bureaucracy. Usually, he was a very smart bureaucratic player, Dick Cheney. He put people in the legal departments of all the agencies where all the paper flows so that he would know what policies were bubbling up before the president did. And, vice presidents usually have the ear of the president. So a combination of Bush's inexperience and Cheney's brilliant manipulation of the bureaucracy gave him unparalleled power. And so a lot that went wrong can be laid at his feet. But, then again, it was George W. Bush who was the decider. He ultimately was responsible, and he, I don't think, only listened to Dick Cheney. He listened to a lot of people, and he listened to his own gut. So the decisions were his, but Cheney's influence was unquestionably very, very high in that first term.
Well, in a way, though, it felt like when he came out on the White House lawn to say he was the decider, he was doing it somewhat defensively who didn't think that the president was in charge? You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. That's right. I think that's right. But both George W. Bush and George Herbert Walker Bush have that odd tendency to sort of vocalize the directions of their stage managers, right? Message, I care. Remember that one from Bush's father? So, yeah, it's sort of they reveal what they're actually thinking sometimes.
Well, Paul Glasrost, your new ebook, which I mentioned, is a compilation of the writing of some of the best political journalists in Washington, Elephant in the Room, Washington in the Bush Years, points out that we're still feeling the reverberations of the Bush years in an unfinished war, an enduring recession, and the long shadow of Supreme Court appointments and decisions, and the possibility of a new period of unified GOP control of Washington, which remains very real. Now, do you think, usually in midterms, the vote goes against the White House, but there are indications now that maybe there is some pushback from the against the NRA, who sort of basically seem to be the juggernaut that rolls over everybody in Washington, that there may be something stirring with Gabby Giffords, with Kelly Ayotte's numbers going down because of this vote that they took against a very modest background check bill. Is it possible that in 2014 the Democrats will stop expecting to lose, as they usually do, and liberals and progressives have that pathology, it seems. Look at the Senate. They can't even get a majority vote there for some reason or other. They allow this usurpation of power, expecting a 60-vote threshold. So are we going to see a wake-up here, a fight, you know, in other words, a real fight to – because nothing's going to improve in this country in the ways that the majority want things until the majority vote.
Well, I think that to the point about whether the vote on the gun legislation might energize Democrats and be detrimental to those who oppose the president, I think there's something to it. We really haven't talked gun legislation in this country in a long time, and it really – It came upon us with Newtown, and the forces who are interested in modest common sense gun legislation really only had a couple of months to pull themselves together, and the public wasn't mobilized as in a full. It wasn't part of an election. The groups hadn't been fully energized. I do think that there's a chance that Democrats will be able to bring their base on to the polls with the help of that issue, in the midterm of a president's second term, a president almost always loses votes in Congress. The exception was 1998. Bill Clinton gained 5 House seats. That was during impeachment, and the public, the economy was strong, his approval ratings were high, and the Republicans way overstepped, and they paid a price. And I have to wonder if the public doesn't see the resistance to change, the constant opposition of the Republicans as a kind of building up a sense of frustration with them that might redound to the Democrats' benefit.
And the gridlock. I mean,
exactly. Yeah. The gridlock. I mean, people do want to see government get things done, and I do not think that I think that the chance of getting immigration reform is less than 50-50. If nothing gets done between now and 2014, and we have more fights as Republicans in the House want to have over the debt limit, I think that moderate-ish Republicans are pulling their hair out and can see disaster looming because of what their base is not allowing Republicans to do.
Right, but this all depends upon the Democrats stepping up and manning up and doing the job, and
Well, I mean, if manning up means blowing up the filibuster, I think you're right. Democrats gained House seats and gained Senate seats in this last election. Republicans have lost the majority in 5 of the last 6 presidential elections. So it's not like Democrats haven't been winning. As long as the system allows for filibusters of everything, which it does, and the Democrats don't change that, then certainly nothing's going to happen in the Senate. And as long as Republicans hold the House, it's very, very difficult to get anything done. And so I'm not sure what more the Democrats can do other than win the next election or two.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here, Paul Glastris.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Paul Glasser, who's the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly and a senior fellow at the Western Policy Center in Washington, D.C. He was a special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton and wrote over 200 speeches for the president on subjects ranging from education to health care to the budget. Before joining the White House, Paul Glasser spent 10 years as a correspondent and editor at U.S. News & World Report. His new e-book is Elephant in the Room, Washington in the Bush Years. We're going to take a brief station break. We look into come back and look into why America loses its head over terror but ignores its daily gun deaths.
He's a real nowhere man, sitting in his nowhere land, making all his nowhere plans for nobody. Doesn't